Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, PA. And if you have heard me on this podcast in the last 75 episodes, you know that I don't take money for this. It's just a project I've done because I wanted to see more people run for office instead of just voting. Voting's important, but that's my goal. And so you know that there's only one organization that I've really promoted as something that people should support, and that is Run for Something. It's something a few of the people I've talked to on here have gone through that process. And today, for my personal birthday special, I'm going to call it, I am excited to have one of the founders of Run for Something as my guest, Ross Morales Rocchetto. Thank you so much for joining today. I am thrilled to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me, and happy birthday whenever your birthday is.
My birthday is on June 15th, and I am turning 40. And now that I'm turning 40, I'm seeing that there are a lot of really impressive people who are a lot younger than me right now.
Well, congrats, you made it.
Yeah, well, I think anyone that's okay today in June 2020, you can say congrats to making it at this point. So I've mentioned this on my podcast a few times to people. The reason I started doing this and talking to people in 2018, Democrats won the House of Representatives and won some important governor's races and other state legislative races, started making momentum in 2017. And I was telling people to vote, but I saw that there were a lot of races where there are just no good candidates. And now there's this group, Run for Something, that started in 2017, and it's making a big, big impact. So Ross, tell me a little bit about what is Run for Something.
Sure. So I'll just like also give a little bit of background on like how we like came into existence, which is like I've been working in politics since the first time I worked on a campaign was 2002.
Me too.
Running for awesome, yay! For a guy running for U.S. Senate in Texas named Ron Kirk. I'm from Texas originally, and Ron Kirk did not win that race. It was also John Cornyn's first ever U.S. Senate race, and also the last time he had a competitive Senate race, except for this year. So we'll see what happens in Texas this year. You'll probably hear me talk about Texas more. I'm from there, and my love for Texas has never died, even though I haven't lived there since I was 22. So, but yeah, we got started, you know, in the aftermath of the 2016 election cycle. You know, I was working for a large Democratic super PAC at the time in Washington, D.C. during 2016. My co-founder, Amanda, was working for the Clinton campaign. And my wife actually connected us after the election because, you know, I had been fed up for a long time with a lot of the candidates that I'd seen out there and had worked with over the years. And Amanda was getting, you know, calls from friends of hers who were, you know, like about, like, you know, who were in their 20s and 30s saying, like, is there an organization out there that would support me if I want to run for office? And she couldn't, like, point to one specifically. So we started talking. We started writing a plan. We put up a website. We launched on Inauguration Day in 2017. Thinking, you know, like this would be a side hustle. I had like accepted a gig to go manage a congressional race out in California. Amanda at the time was working for Tom Perriello in his run for governor of Virginia. And, you know, like we just thought like if we were lucky, 100 people would sign up and that this would be a fun side hustle. Well, on the first day, about 1,000 people signed up. And then in the first few months, 10,000 people signed up. And as of today, we have over 50,000 folks who have told us that they're interested in running for office in every state, plus DC and the United States. So it's been really amazing to watch like the specific things that we do for candidates, and it's evolved over time. We do a couple of basic things. So like at our core, like our like mission is to recruit and support young, diverse, progressive folks who are running for state and local office for the first or second time. Mm-hmm. So the ways that we do that, there's a couple of ways that we do that. The first is, like, we get people connected to the resources that exist out in the democratic and progressive space already. It's really hard to navigate, like, all of the different groups and all of the different, like people who are out there. And so a big part of what we try to do is we try to simplify that to folks and make sure they understand who's out there, how can they get help, like, where do all of, like, the pieces fit together. So a really good example is, like, we have a deep partnership with the National Democratic Training Committee. They have a suite of online trainings that are free for anyone who wants to take them, and they're pretty good, you know, for especially for folks who are thinking about running for, like, down ballot offices. So we make sure we push all of our candidates as they're starting to think about whether they want to run for office, we push them there. We've also put together a tool where people can literally go to a website, runforwhat.net, and, like, look up where they can run for office in their local area and some of the, like, available offices. At the end of this month, right now, it has mostly 2020 races in, and as, you know, like, folks who are probably listening to this know, like, many of the 2020 filing deadlines have passed. By the end of this month, we'll have 2021 races up there. So if you're thinking about running in 2021, you'll be able to go there and look, or you and see, like, what you can run for in your area. You know, the other thing that we do is for candidates that we endorse, we make sure we, like, assign those folks an individual person from the Run for Something team to work with them throughout the life cycle of their campaign. So they're, like, one part coach, one part consultant, you know, one part therapist. They're just, like, there for you, you know, through the entire time. They can help you write your campaign plan. You know, they can, like, help coach you through, like, your call time and all of those types of things. And then, you know, another big part of what we do that we've heard from a lot of our candidates that's really useful is making sure that we are leveraging the alumni network that we have. We have, you know, like, over 1,000 people who we've endorsed who have run for office at this point, and making sure that our current candidates get access to people who have done it before. So for anyone who wants one, we connect them to somebody who has run for office previously, either in a similar type of district or in the same area if the politics sort of, like, align, which they don't always. Right. So, you know, we do a bunch of other things that's, like, on the support side. We also do a ton of work around candidate recruitment, whether that's running digital ads. We did a big experiment in Texas at the end of last year where we spent over $100,000 on digital ads to recruit people for specific races around the state. We, you know, are always, like, working with, like, state and local media partners to get the word out about elections. You know, and then we have, like, a team of people whose job it is to, like, work with the state and local infrastructure in different states to help, like, do candidate recruitment work, you know, for, like, very specific areas. So we're doing a lot with a pretty small team. The work is amazing. And, you know, like, I would say as we, you know, like, as, like, the 2020 has been just a garbage fire of a year.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, like, the fact that I get to wake up every morning and do this work feels like a real honor and privilege. And it, like, makes me feel inspired every day, even when, like, it's really hard to sit down and, like, actually do work.
Yes, it is. It's very hard to focus. But, you know, as I think about focus, I also think that every candidate, every person has a focus of why they jumped in. While you aren't running for something yourself, you had a focus for why you first got into politics, right? And why you first went to work on that campaign in 2002. What was the thing that motivated you? Like, I gotta change things.
So the reason that I think I love politics the way that I do, there's two reasons. First, like, I learned at a very early, I love basketball. It's my favorite sport. I played basketball through high school. I wasn't very good. Mm-hmm. And actually, I realized very quickly basketball is never going to be a career for me. And so once I sort of, like, got over the heartbreak of that, you know, like, I was looking for something else to love. And, you know, a thing that happened when I was 10 or 11 years old You know, I don't come from like a particularly religious family, but my parents thought it was really important for me to go to church when I was younger. So they took me to church every Sunday, and I super hated it. I was a pretty loud kid. I have a loud voice. They always told me to use my inside voice, which I didn't know how to do. I always asked like awkward questions of Sunday school teachers, and they would always put me in time out because they didn't like the questions I was asking, or just didn't have answers for them. And, you know, when I was 10 or 11, my parents realized it wasn't really working. So they came to me with like a deal. They were like, we will agree not to take you to church anymore if every Sunday you agree to have breakfast with us. And get out of bed at like 10 a.m. to have breakfast. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a sweet deal. I get to like sleep in more than I would have otherwise. I get to have breakfast. I don't have to go to church anymore. I don't like that. So we did that. And so every Sunday morning, basically starting from when I was 10 or 11 all the way through when I was 18, with, you know, like very few exceptions, I would have breakfast with my parents and watch Meet the Press. Mm-hmm. And... you know, I remember...
Nothing's more radicalizing than Meet the Press.
I know. It's, like, really weird. It's a really weird story. When I'm, like... and when I was 13 or 14, I started to realize that, like, the people going on Meet the Press didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like, the things they were saying, like, didn't feel in alignment with the reality as I had understood it. And so I started asking my parents questions. And it sort of became clear to me then that, like, most politicians were full of shit. Like, I was a 13 or 14 year old being like, oh wow, like, these people aren't that smart and they're totally full of shit. Sorry if I'm not supposed to curse.
Trust me, my I'm a 4 year old and a 6 year old, and they curse more than a lot of adults I know, unfortunately.
And so, you know, like, that sparked my interest in politics, I think. And then you know, I didn't know that I was like a little budding organizer, but there were signs all along the way, some like fun stories that I won't go into here. But like, you know, I got to my junior or senior year of high school, and I had a government teacher who said, you know, for part of your credit in this class, you've got to go volunteer for a campaign. It doesn't matter which campaign it is, mm-hmm. all that stuff. You just like got to go do it, and you got to like keep a journal about it. And I was like, okay, that sounds like straightforward and easy. So I looked around. You know, like I made phone calls. It was, you know, there wasn't really email at that time, or it wasn't like widespread. So I called a bunch of like candidates that I found, and the Ron Kirk campaign called me back. And I went in, had a sort of like great experience working in their Houston office. And then like a good organizer, I convinced all of the other folks in my class to go work for the same campaign as me. And that was like really the start. And, you know, I think as I got older, I didn't sort of like realize at that moment sort of like how impactful like folks, you know, like running for like elected officials could be. It probably wasn't until 2005, when I worked for Julian Castro's first campaign for mayor in San Antonio, that I realized like what like a really truly like special candidate could do to inspire people. And you know, like we got outspent in that race 11-1. And we only lost by about 3,300 votes. And the way that, you know, he galvanized the community of San Antonio around him, and the way that he inspired so many people, I just, like, was so special, and was something that I had never seen before. And, like, really, I think is what, like, drew me in and solidified the fact that, like, I knew that politics was what I wanted to do. I think the way that a lot of people felt about Barack Obama in 2008 was how I felt about Julian Castro in 2005. And then, you know, like all of my first, you know, dozen races that I worked on were at the state and local level, city council, school board, state rep. In Texas, people run for judge. So I worked for a couple judicial candidates. And so, you know, this was like a long-winded, I gave you the long version of my story. But, you know, like a lot of it was I got hooked early, and then I got to like see what it looked like when somebody who was truly special was on the ballot and inspired people.
Yeah, and it sounds like from what you said from Meet the Press and then from Julian Castro, who, you know, I love hearing him as well, that the thing that inspired you both in a negative way and a positive way was either people not listening to people like you, or that they were listening. It sounds like, you know, you need politicians out there and candidates who are listening to other voices, where you can hear, you can understand what they're saying. And I imagine there's a lot of candidates who are going through Run for Something now who feel like their voice, their concerns are not being heard in one way or another.
Yeah, a thing that we frequently say is, like, you can't be what you can't see. You know, if all you see is white dudes who are lawyers running for office, that's what you're going to think an elected official is.
Right.
And that's why it's so important. I think, like, the work that you're doing is so important, you know, to, like, show people what it looks like, you know, for folks who are from, like, non-traditional backgrounds to run for office. Because it isn't just for one type of person. It's for, like, anyone. Honestly, like, it's for people who give a shit about their community and, like, have a problem or series of problems that they feel like they understand and can solve. So yeah, I think that's like a huge part of the work that we try to do. It's clearly the work that you're doing, and it's so important. You know, like, we just can't keep putting folks up there that look the same. Even, you know, and I think this is, like, really important, like, distinguishing characteristic here, like, you know, we can't just keep putting folks who, like, went to Harvard, moved home, you know, like, decided to run for office.
Right, because it's not representative. Most people didn't go to Harvard.
Yeah, most people didn't go to Harvard, and one of our operating principles at Run for Something is that communities already have the things that they need to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And we see our job as helping support the folks who are already in those communities.
Yeah, I think that's important. And there's also, from everything I've heard and seen, lots of people who a few years ago and other political organizations would have told them, you know, you're really great, you're really, you're a special person, you should go work on a campaign, but you might not be the right person for this district. I imagine your tone to someone like that would be very different from those other political organizations from years ago.
Yeah, I think, like, I wrote, like, an op-ed, like, a couple years ago about, like, the word viability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the word that keeps getting thrown, that gets thrown around a lot with our candidates. And just with, like, folks who don't look like white rich lawyers, to be honest, who are looking to run for office. I think we need to scrub that word from our vocabulary, in large part because, you know, the world is changing. And I think whether it's an armchair quarterback at home who's, like, trying to figure out, like, which presidential candidate is going to, like, resonate with, like, a specific white person that they've imagined in their mind in, like, Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, or it's a political operative like me who's been working in the business for 18 years and, like, thinks that they know better than other people. I think, you know, the ways that we have evaluated as sort of, like, in a political space, like, the candidates that are running, they're just off. Like, the folks who are winning are people who don't look or sound like a traditional politician. I think actually a really excellent example to point to is, you know, I could give a bunch of examples of Run for Something candidates, but, like, an example that more folks might be familiar with is in Kentucky, where Amy McGrath is running for U.S. Senate in a primary right now. And she has, I think the guy's name is Charles Booker,
right?
Who's challenging her in the Democratic primary, and everyone had written Charles Booker off. He's a state rep, and he's a special candidate. He's extremely talented, and he has something to say. And he's giving Amy McGrath a run for her money. She's raised over $11 million. She's having to fight for that primary, and she may not win.
Right.
And, you know, she was the hand-picked candidate of the DSCC, and she might still pull it out. She, you know, like, has a great, she has a great story. There's nothing inherently wrong with her, and she's not, she doesn't seem to be connecting with voters in Kentucky, and you know, especially not in the same way that Charles Booker is. And so I think, you know, we need to really think about, you know, when we, and actually let me say this, and that's why I think it's really important for us to embrace primaries.
Yeah, we just had a competitive primary in my state senate district, and the Run for Something candidate Amanda Cappelletti won. And
she's great.
I know. My wife and I voted for her. So there, we can go into. I don't want to go into the details of that, but you know, some people get unhappy because there is a primary, but it boosts interest in different issues. It boosts issues in character. It boosts issues in you know, toughening people up to get them ready for a general, enthusiasm, list building. I remember for years working in politics, and people were like, oh, we need to avoid a primary. I'm like, well, then you spend months not doing anything.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's just the fact that, like, nobody deserves the office.
Right.
Like, there isn't one person who deserves that office. And I think it's really important to, like, keep that at the front of our minds, is that if the voters think that that person is the best person to represent them in the district, and there's a primary, like if there's an incumbent, for example, the incumbent will win if the voters feel like they've done a good job.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't feel like they've done a good job, they'll pick someone else. And that's also okay, because ultimately we should be leaving this up to the voters.
Right. So one of the things I really appreciate that you guys aren't there, like, you know, you talk to a lot of people who are a little bit familiar with politics, and like, oh, we got to win the presidency, we got to win the Senate, or this governor's got to win. But you're focused so much on the other races, state rep, city council, mayor, judge, etc. I talked with Emily Segrist, and she, I don't think, was involved with Run for Something, maybe too early, whatever. And she's in Wisconsin. And in 2018, Evers won. He beat Scott Walker in a squeaker of an election. And I think you and I are both thrilled that Scott Walker's not in elected office anymore. But
indeed.
You need those down ballot races to get the other race up. Like, Joe Biden's not going to win Pennsylvania if all of the other Democratic candidates down ballot stink, right?
Yep, that's totally real. I think, you know, we need to be running people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just because, you know, like, a big part of that is because that's how you build a pipeline, right? Like, that is, like, running folks everywhere is how you build a pipeline. We also nobody knows anything anymore. So, like, districts that were never competitive for Democrats are all of a sudden, like, within striking distance. And if you don't put someone up in those districts, then we don't know how close we can actually get to winning.
Or they get to from a 30% Democratic turnout in 2018 to now a 45% turnout. So, yeah, they didn't win, but they made it competitive, so they'll get better funded in 2022.
Yep, exactly. And they also, you know, as you were referencing, like, there's a reverse coattails effect. So, like, the folks that are doing that work, you know, we know that the best form of a way to talk to a voter is for a candidate to have a one-on-one conversation with them. That just, all of the research mm-hmm. says it. It's been, like, widely established. And, you know, like, we, like, down ballot candidates are, like, organizers. And if they're out there talking to voters, having those one-on-one conversations, you know, they're going to get votes for the top of the ticket that the folks at the top of the ticket were never going to be able to talk to. Joe Biden isn't going to be able to have one-on-one conversations with basically any voter, you know, like, with, like, a handful of voters, but he's not going to be able to really have one-on-one conversations with voters. Tom Wolf isn't going to be able to have a lot of one-on-one conversations with voters. There's one of them, and there's too many people. So the things they rely on are mass communications means. But at the local level, folks like you, for example, as an elected official, can go out and have a one-on-one conversation with voters and possibly move the needle with them in a way that, a TV ad or a direct mail piece or a digital ad is never going to be able to move the needle on. And so it's really, really important to make sure that we're running folks everywhere for basically everything. It's also really important, and I'll say this, to make sure that we are running a diverse slate of candidates everywhere. I think, the argument that only a white candidate can win in this district, I think has been disproven now in place after place. I think an amazing example that also is in this Kentucky race, in a state that is overwhelmingly white, there is a black man in a Democratic primary who looks like he's going to beat the DSC, or he has a chance to beat the DSCC picked candidate. And so I think it's really important for us to think about the types of candidates we're recruiting. I know, in a bunch of Midwest states this cycle, the folks who have done a lot of the recruiting, a lot of the slates are extremely white. And so I think it's just really, really important for us to also think about, how we're applying an equity framework to a lot of this work as well. Because, it's great to have candidates out there. And if those candidates, if those candidates aren't representative of the world we want, we're losing voices, we're losing perspectives that we really, really need in our state legislatures, in our city councils, in our county elected positions. So I'd also add that piece to it.
Yeah, I'm excited because, while it's really cool talking with you, and I appreciate Run for Something, my next guest that I'm recording with this weekend, it just won a city council race in West Virginia, and she is the first transgender person to win a race in West Virginia. So diversity helps.
That's amazing.
Diversity helps everywhere, and I imagine when people go to your website and they see, this Hispanic person won in this state, or this transgender person won here, or this person of whatever the background is, well, if they can win in Iowa, then they can win in Pennsylvania, and then it will encourage other people no matter where they live.
Totally. And I think, the last thing I'll say on this is, I'll just give a plug for, because, we talk a lot about president, senate, and we're even starting to talk more about state house races and state senate races because redistricting's coming up. And we got so thoroughly beat back in 2010. I think we've all sort of realized collectively that we can't let that happen again. But the thing that I think we haven't talked, that we don't talk a lot about, and we're hoping at Run for Something to talk a lot more about in the coming weeks and months, is the importance of city council races, the importance of mayoral races, the importance of the county races, the school board races, etc. I don't need to explain it to you as a city council person. And I think the thing, I think a really good example that has been really that's been galvanizing folks right now, is the movement around defunding police. If that is a thing you want to do, that has to happen at the state and local, that has to happen at the local level. There are things that state legislatures can do, but ultimately that work, around police accountability is going to happen, in counties and cities. And, there are so many other things like that, that impact people's daily lives that are decisions that are made at the city, just at the local level. I think it's really important for us to focus on that. And I also think the other thing that's really important to realize is that as a Democrat, Democrats have presided over these cities for decades. And police violence has continued to be a problem for, in most of these departments for decades. And so, I think the other piece of it that's really important is that it's not just enough to elect somebody, and so many of these local offices are are technically nonpartisan. But it's not just enough to elect someone who, like, talks like a Democrat or, like, puts a D next to their name in the cities where you can. It's really important to elect people who, like, are deeply rooted in their communities and who really understand the issues and are committed to getting shit done. Yeah. Because I think for, like, a long time, we've put a lot of folks in these offices who aren't bad. They're not, like, bad people. What happens is they get complacent.
Mm-hmm.
It's really difficult. You know, like, the police unions have a lot of power. There's a lot of, you know, like, there's a lot of issues, or there's a lot of, like, players at the state or at the local and municipal level who have a lot of power that you don't really see operating, like the real estate folks, you know, like people like that. And those are the people who tend to fund those races, and it's really difficult to fight against it. And so, sorry, you can hear my cats in the background.
Oh,
they're
okay.
They're playing. Sorry. They're, like, literally right next to me playing. But, like, you know, it's really important, you know, to elect folks who are going to be willing, you know, who are willing to go out on a limb and, like, take those risky votes, you know, to stand up to, like, the different types of lobbies that exist at the municipal level. And I think we're going to see, I think this moment is showing us, is shining a light, a really bright light on it. And I think, you know, like, as a Democrat, like, it's something that we have to own as a party, and we have to own fixing that too.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that you're fixing that is exciting to someone like me is there's so many times as a Democrat where I want people to be engaged on their own. I don't want to have to tell everyone to vote. I don't want to have to tell everyone to do something. And when I remember in 2016 having someone knock on my door for a candidate, and I didn't know who they were, and they were from my neighborhood. And I was, instead of being like, oh, you're not supporting my candidate, I was thrilled because, one, they weren't supporting my candidate, so they had a different point of view, and two, they were doing this on their own instead of me having to do it. My governing is better when more people feel inspired to get involved, and, you know, it makes a lot of people who I think are on the fence about an issue or want to do something progressive, but there aren't other candidates on their side, you're not only going to have your 300 candidates plus that have won make that difference, but the people that they will convince through this process who are already in office, it'll shift them left as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a thing that this is not you, especially from, like, the way you're talking, like, but there are so many elected officials that I have, like, worked with or run across over the years who see, like, accountability efforts, like, from the community as a bad thing, you know, who, like, look at it and they're like, I just wish they'd, like, let me, like, do this thing on my own. And I think we need to be electing folks who see it as, like, a benefit, you know, like, their constituents are giving them political cover to do the right thing. Like, they're not just, like, going out and doing the right thing on your own without knowing, like, what a majority of your constituents think. Like, you have, like, hundreds of constituents that showed up at a meeting to say, like, you should, you know, if you're on a school board, like, you know, revoke your contract with, like, the local police department. Like, that gives you cover to do that work. And so I think it's also really important to have candidates who understand, like, what you were just saying, that, like, having community voices involved isn't a bad thing. Even when you don't always agree with them, it's a good thing. They're pushing you, you know, like, and they're pushing our elected officials to do things that they may not have done otherwise. And that's a really, I think that's a good thing. I remember talking to a friend of mine. Her name is Leni Stamp. She's an activist, and she works for the Working Families Party.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, like, she just, I think, like, just took over Selena Gomez's Instagram account a day or two ago. Or
I was
going to
do that,
remember.
So I'm
she's great. I remember her saying something to the effect of, back in 2016, like, during the primaries, you know, I'm voting for the person that I'm going to organize against, you know, when I'm probably butchering this a little bit, when they get elected. And it's because she understands and knows that, like, no elected official is going to be perfect on everything. And to a large degree, like, all of her advocacy and activism work, you know, it's not going to stop when even if we elect the candidates that, like, you know, a large majority of, like, activists want, for example, you're still going to have to push them. Like, you can't, like, let the pressure up, because, you know, it's really easy. People aren't bad people in the most people in the political system who are Democrats are not, like, bad people. I'm not going to try to speak to Republicans.
That's okay.
we'll leave that for someone else.
Right.
And they exist in a system that makes it easy for them to be complacent and to just sort of, like, vote for the stat and, like, to maintain the status quo. It's just easy. Like, it's very easy to fall into it. And so I think that's why, like, that tension is really important. And I think it's why that tension is really important to have that tension, you know, for elected officials to embrace that tension. Because if they don't, then they end up with an adversarial relationship with their community.
Right. And I think that as long as it is a respectful tension, or not always respectful, depending on what it is, but, you know, you would rather have a tension between people who are at different levels on the left than a tension between a really bad person and someone at the other end. You know, you would rather be just tugging it along. And the right has been doing this for decades, moving, Newt Gingrich was doing this in the 70s and 80s, getting people to run for school board and all these things. And now you have, you know, the Freedom Caucus and all these stuff pushing people to the right. If we get good, diverse, progressive Democrats at all levels of government, it's going to start pulling it back to the other end, where all of these progressive things that maybe a lot of Democrats wanted to do for years now are more palatable to do.
Totally. I think that works the same way at the state and local level. And sure, and there are bad actors. I think, you know, like the NIMBY folks are often bad actors, not always, and most of the time, in some of this stuff. And so, like, you know, it isn't to say there aren't bad actors, and it is to say that, like, I actually think what's happening right now in the movement for Black Lives is, like, really beautiful and, like, really, really strategic and smart, mm-hmm. which is that, like, you know, they're talking about defunding the police, and you see folks out there, you know, like Alicia Garza, who's, like, one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, on the press, like, over the weekend, talking about what defunding the police means. And I think what they've done that is, like, such a sort of, like, brilliant, decision is that, you know, they've made it more than just about abolishing police departments, although I think ultimately that might be, like, the goal for many folks. So I don't want to brush that aside, because for many that is the ultimate goal. And I think what they've sort of, like, also strategically recognized is, like, people are going to do different things here. And they're going to experiment with different types of ways, because it's like you defund the police and there's inherently an and attached to it. Nobody's saying just, like, defund the police, period, right? They're saying defund the police and dot, dot, dot. You know, defund the police and put more money into mental health services. Defund the police and, like, put more, like, investment dollars in Black communities. Defund the police and, you know, like, end mass incarceration. Right. I think there's the and part to it. And I know folks I've seen all the debates about whether it's, like, a smart slogan or not. And, you know, like, I'm not going to get into that at all. You know, I don't think it's my job to question, you know, like, the slogan that, like, a movement that has, like, really moved the needle, you know, like, significantly over the last 5 years is going with. So I think what's been really smart is that, like, there's so much room to create there right now, right? And they've built the infrastructure in cities across America to push elected officials, their state and local elected officials, to start experimenting with those things. So, like, we can, you know, the running for office and becoming an elected official and voting are not sufficient to solve those problems. They are one part of solving the problems. And the part they are is if we put good people in who are willing to listen to their communities, then the folks over here, you know, who are out protesting and, you know, who are like with the movement for Black Lives or, you know, like belong to a Black Lives Matter chapter or just like getting involved, you know, for the first time, they can push their elected officials to do things. And if we have elected officials that are there that are willing to listen, then like that's how this system works, like works. And that's like that's what happens when it works really, really well. So I think it's really inspiring to see what they're doing. I was just talking to someone the other day who, you know, like works really deeply with the movement for Black Lives. And, you know, like, I think there's a lot of hope right now. I think, you know, for those that are on the side of freedom and justice, like, we're winning right now in a way that I don't think anyone could have predicted, you know, even a month ago.
Right.
So
I know my Trump-loving...
I think we're in a really beautiful moment.
Yeah, even my Trump-loving neighbors, and I have a twin house, and my neighbor who shares my house puts hand-painted signs for Trump, which is very hard for me to walk on. He did that. He doesn't have it all the time, but it's tough. But even he, I've heard say, like, look, I oppose this, but I also oppose police brutality. And, like, all right, well, just the fact that you have said that is already shifting the debate because this has pulled you in this direction.
Yeah, like, I think it's, like, really, you know, and I think the credit for this goes to the movement, right? Like, this is their victory. And, you know, like, cynically, like, I didn't think we would get here nearly this quickly. I didn't know that we'd get here in 10 years, 20 years. And I think, like, now the place that we're in is, like, we have a moment and a window to, like, make sure that, like, we don't backslide. And I think that's why the work that the movement side is doing is so important. I think that's also why the work that, like, we and Color of Change and Collective Pack and, you know, Higher Heights and the, you know, like the Movement for Black Lives Electoral Project and Working Families Party, all of us are in us, all the work that we're doing to make sure that we're electing more folks who are open to these types of policy, like who are open to defunding police and investing in Black communities in some way. You know, I think that's why that work is even more pivotal right now. And, you know, I think the stakes are only going to get higher. You know, every election that I've ever been a part of, I think, like, you've probably seen this too. Like, every single election cycle that I've ever been a part of, we have always said was the most important election cycle of our lifetime.
Right.
That will always be true. Every election cycle that we ever participate in will always be the most important election cycle, you know, like in that particular moment. And I think, like, and it's because the stakes just keep getting higher and higher. So I'm really excited and inspired to do this work. I'm really grateful for the work that you do, both as an elected official, but also, you know, like trying to like share the voices of like folks who are running for office and sort of demystify it. I think that's the Lord's work.
Yeah, well, I appreciate what you're doing. Before we go, because you've given me so much time and I appreciate it, finally, if people are interested in running at this moment for 2020, 2021, where should they go? What should be their first stop and, you know, their first email, I guess?
Yeah, I would go to runforwhat.net. It's mm-hmm. the website that we put together to so that people could look up where they can run in their local communities. If you know you want to run, like, already, and you, like, know what you're running for, you should go to runforsomething.net, and you should sign up as a candidate, and then someone would, you know, like, you will get a follow-up from the organization.
Awesome. I think it's so important. You have so many, there are 500,000 elected positions in this country. Some of them have great candidates on both sides of the aisle, even, or have great candidates in the primary, but many of them have no one good running, or even the incumbents themselves wish someone would run. You can make a difference if you run for something. Please follow Run for Something, follow Ross, follow Amanda, follow everyone at Run for Something. And I think together we can make this a better world. Thank you so much, Ross. I appreciate it. And good luck to you in 2020, and not just in 2020, but over the next 10, 20 years.
Totally. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.